You're listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Mother Earth is under the weather right now. Mother Earth is under the weather right now. We are the caretakers, guardians of the earth, caretakers.
Currently, we're using up the resources of several planets. This is only possible because we mine solar power stored over millions of years in coal, oil, and gas. We also use up forests built up over millennia. Most of us sense this wild ride of consumption is heading for a dead end. Could we make this civilization last?
What do we need to become really sustainable?
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. In today's program, we hear from one of Europe's best experts, a Green who has the ear of both business and government, and yet the trust of millions of people. Jonathan Port is easily the most recognized Green spokesman in Britain. In the 1970s, he founded what was to become the Green Party of the UK and became its co-chair for 6 years, while earning his living as a teacher. From 1984 to 1990, he was executive director of Friends of Earth UK, now a huge environmental force in Britain. Following the publication of several books, Port extended his efforts to greening the business community. In 2000, Tony Blair appointed Port as chairman of the country's Sustainable Development Commission. Port also co-founded Forum for the Future, the country's largest sustainability organization. He also advises the Prince of Wales and serves as a trustee for the World Wildlife UK. Throughout, Port weighed in to countless issues through television, radio, newspapers, and public appearances as a voice of ecological conscience. His sixth and latest book is Capitalism, As If It Matters. On May 2nd, Port led a discussion in the round at the WASC Center for Dialogue in Vancouver, Canada. The topic? A sustainable future. Whose business is it anyway? The speech was organized by Simon Fraser University and sponsored by business and professional organizations, including the BC Principals and Vice Principals Association. Port was introduced by Milton Wong, a chancellor of SFU and chair of HSBC Investments of Canada. Today, we're going to present this 44-minute speech. It began with the troubling state of the world assessment, but followed with visions of how we can tackle a growing list of threats. Not surprisingly, Port called for a more realistic education program, looking not to a past of cheap oil, consumption, and business as usual, but a future of balance amid new challenges like climate change, overpopulation, and ecological stress. As a former teacher, he still sees a key role for education and much more input from young people. The evening was far from over. For the next hour and a half, educators, business people, environmentalists, and a very informed public questioned Jonathan Porritt. We were exposed to a green mind at work, not with simple formulas, but struggling with contradictions, as we all do. The whole question and answer period is available as a free download from the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. Look in the Climate Solutions section of our Audio On Demand menu. As a sample, we'll hear one question from Adrian Carr, the longtime environmentalist and green politician, and Porritt's response. But first, this important speech from Jonathan Porritt.
Milton, Paul, thank you very much indeed, and thank you for making it possible for me to be here for a few days in Vancouver. It's a real privilege, an opportunity for me to see how the issues that preoccupy me, dominate my life, are being reflected here in Canada, British Columbia, and to take away some of that experience so that it can help feed into the stuff that I'm doing back in the UK. They've given me a huge amount of time to stun your brains this evening. I won't be taking advantage of all of that time, but I do want to spend about 40 minutes doing two things. One, hopefully, bringing us to a shared point about what's happening to this world of ours and where we are now. And I'm going to do that unapologetically on a global basis. I can't turn up here in your midst in Canada and pretend to give you anything like an authoritative account of the way in which all of these sustainability issues are being reflected in your country. So I'm not even going to try. I've done enough reading to make sure that I don't embarrass myself when I'm doing radio interviews, but apart from that, I'm not really on my home territory here, so I'm not going to try and persuade you that I am. So I'm going to take a global pitch for that, look at where we are in this continuously expanding world of ours, and try and distill some of the implications of that. And then the second half will be to look at the whole educational challenge that arises out of that analysis. And to do so, I hope, in quite a provocative way, starting from the assumption that most of our educational endeavours at the moment are entirely unfit for purpose in a very different world today. And I know that'll be a little bit provocative, but I think it's meant to be a little bit provocative, so I'm going to take advantage of the license you have given me. And I was struck, actually, of the analogy between inappropriate educational and teaching methodologies and practice, the analogy between that and climate change. And I'll come on and talk a little bit about climate change in a moment. But you will all know, as sort of experienced old hands in this area, that the warming effect, the changes that we're seeing in the climate today, are the consequence of the warming that we caused 20 years ago, of the emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases which were put into the atmosphere 20 years ago. They're not being caused by the emissions that we're putting up there today. In a way, it'd be quite reassuring if they were. It's actually much more worrying to think that everything that's happening today is a consequence of the emissions 20 years ago. And the analogy is a simple one, that the wholly inadequate mindsets of most of our business and political leaders today are a consequence of the polluted educational systems to which they were exposed 20 years ago. And if we're looking about mindset change for a sustainable future, we have to start with that period of time that young people spend in schools and then in colleges to prepare them, enable them, to take on, not necessarily leadership roles, but to take on participatory roles in a world that is changing very dramatically. So, in essence, getting to grips with the educational challenge is the only means that we have of ensuring that mindsets 20 years out there are in some way going to be sensitized to, sympathetic to the kind of very dramatic changes that we're talking about now. So, just very briefly, this is what the forum does. We've been around now for 12 years or more. I've been doing this for much longer than that. I joined the Green Party in the UK in 1974, so I've sort of been banging away at this stuff for a long time. But something happened to me in the early 90s, particularly at the Earth Summit in 1992, when I suddenly got very tired of having to pursue this agenda via negative campaigning. I'd spent most of my life in Friends of the Earth and the Green Party at that stage, and I was getting really ground down by having to work with an agenda that was dominated essentially by three critical emotions: fear, guilt, and anger. And there's a limited amount of traction that you can get from playing around with permutations on the fear, guilt, and anger agenda, because most of human nature isn't really like that. Most of human nature is, in fact, aspiring to respond to a different potentiality in each of us, and isn't driven to change as much as it needs to be purely by playing on those emotional chords. So for the last 15 years, I've been doing it differently. I've been doing it through trying to find positive energy and solutions. Now, that is actually pretty difficult when you look out on a world that is, in fact, falling to pieces. And many people believe that we are now nearing what I have described here as the ultimate tipping point. For our species, the ultimate tipping point is the point at which we can no longer command our own destiny. We're the only species, so far as we know, that is capable of actually projecting its own evolution into the future, understanding what it is that might happen to us in the future. But were we to reach that point, where we cease to be able to have any command over our own destiny, that would be an extraordinary turning point in the history of humankind. And when I come on to talk about climate change, you'll see why we might be a little bit closer to that than you might feel comfortable with. I've been around long enough in this movement not to let you escape the reality of population growth. Very few environmentalists these days want to talk about population growth, but actually it lies right at the heart of every single one of the crises that we face in the world today. If we had to fashion a sustainable, equitable, compassionate world for 2 billion people, I'm not sure there'd be much of a problem. I actually believe we could really do that. 6.5 billion people today, getting a bit tougher. 9 billion people, 8.3 by 2025, and 9 billion by 2050. Now that's seriously difficult. You are going to get a bit of doom and gloom to start with, okay? I'm sorry, you just can't avoid it. A, you'd expect it of me, and B, it is there, and you have to have your noses rubbed in it, like I do, just as a sort of regular update. This is the state of the world now. People who've been involved in this movement will recognize this as the state of the world, really, for the last 30 years. Have we actually reversed any of those really big problems? Not seriously. Every single one of the trends in that area are still heading in the wrong direction. They may be heading in the wrong direction more slowly, which I suppose is some relief, but they're still heading in the wrong direction. And I was startled recently to read the latest United Nations Environmental Program report about deforestation. The first campaign that I launched when I went to Friends of the Earth in 1984 was the first international campaign against the deforestation, the destruction of the global rainforest. In 2006, more rainforest was destroyed than in 1986. So we do move very slowly to address some of this stuff. This will remind you how rapidly, though, the demographics of the world are changing and how the economic powerhouses of the world are changing. Here we are now in 2005, and you can see, as far as the rich world population is concerned, we're going to be in almost exactly the same place by 2050. There isn't going to be any significant population growth in the rich nations of the world at all. Indeed, in Europe, we're now contemplating or looking out at the prospect of the population of Europe being at least 50 million people less than it is today. So nearly 100% of the population growth is in fact taking place in what is still described as the poor world. And you can see, interestingly enough, that there's going to be a big turnaround too in the economic levels of economic activity in OECD and non-OECD countries. And poor world is a bad description, of course, because the poor world includes countries like India and China. And in both of those countries, there are many very, very rich people. And those economies are growing very fast in a way that we'll come on to talk about in a moment. This has really focused people's minds in Europe. And not necessarily for a good reason. A bit as it has in America when they look at their southern border. Because just look at what that means in terms of distribution of population between Europe and Europe's neighbors. If you go back to 1950, Europe had twice as many people as its surrounding neighbors. That's basically North Africa and the Middle East. So not untroubled parts of the world, obviously. By 2000, you can see that population growth already in those parts of the world had changed that balance. Project right through to where we are in 2050, you can see the 50 million reduction in population in Europe and this vast, absolutely enormous surge in numbers of people in North Africa and the Middle East. Two parts of the world that still have very, very fast population growth rates. Average fertility still much higher than in the rest of the world. Now, when demographers and politicians look at that figure, they feel a little bit nervous. Because to a certain extent, the instability in the world today is still kept safe by virtue of the poor world not having the power, the influence, the leverage to influence the rich world and make it change its ways. That one little statistical insight is one of the reasons why the right-wing political parties in Europe are increasingly focused on issues to do with immigration, to do with asylum seekers, to do with the whole in-migration of very large numbers of people from other countries, from our neighbors, in a way that is already causing explosive tensions between people in Europe and beyond Europe. Now, this imbalance between the rich and the poor, you can be pretty cynical about this. Many people in politics are. I've used that old cliche which many politicians will trot out when confronted with the reality of inequity, which is, yeah, well, you know, Jonathan, the poor have always been with us, assuming, of course, that the poor will always be with us. This is true. I can't deny that the poor have always been part of any human society at any point in history. It's just the empirical reality. But the degree to which the poor have always been with us has changed from time to time. And if you look at these figures, from this very interesting body, which was set up in 2002 to look at the social implications of globalization, you can see that not only are we living in a world where our physical life support systems are collapsing around us, but we're living in a world which is becoming progressively less and less equitable. It's not a static situation, this. Okay, it's not fixed. This is a permanently, or not permanently, I hope, but it is certainly today, a progressively worsening situation. So 59% live in countries with worsening inequalities, so the gap between rich and poor getting wider, not narrower. Only 5% live in countries where those gaps are actually narrowing. And that includes the usual suspects, which you would expect, countries like Scandinavia, Holland, the Netherlands, and so on. But it also includes countries like Indonesia, interestingly, only because Indonesia, a few years ago, 10 years ago, reached such startling levels of inequity that the narrowing that's going on now has brought it back to something like the mean in that part of the world. That's not good news for people who are looking to build the foundations for a sustainable world. It's part of my take in this whole approach towards sustainable development that you won't arrive at a sustainable world unless you can reduce the inequities in any one society and reduce the inequities globally. So I'm just going to touch now on three big sustainability issues. I like asking people this question because they all have different views about it. When do you think extraction of oil is going to reach that peak moment, the moment when we take more out of the ground in one year than in any preceding year and in any year to come afterwards? You can be guided by the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, who've come up with the date of 2008. This is an organization made up mostly of dissenting geologists who once worked for the large oil companies. So an interesting group of people. Very, very knowledgeable. Very, very skeptical about what the oil companies tell us. Or would you go for the reassuringly distant 2030, which is the BP figure, where John Brown, once when he was still chief executive of BP, I'm not sure I'm allowed to mention him any longer, John Brown would regularly appear before shareholders and say, look, all this stuff about peak oil running out, it's just rubbish. There's no shortage of the stuff. He wasn't talking about unconventional supplies of hydrocarbons. He wasn't talking about your tar sands, for instance. He was just talking about conventional oil. Somebody moving the furniture, is that me doing something wrong? Anyway. Now, I don't know the answer to that question, incidentally, and I guarantee that none of you know the answer to that question either, because the basis on which you might make an informed, intelligent judgment about that, that information is not available to you. We don't actually know, for instance, how much oil is left in Saudi Arabia. It could either be 268 billion barrels of oil or 62 billion barrels of oil, depending on which estimate you choose to believe. With a margin of error that size, it's extremely difficult to come up with an intelligent bet. That doesn't matter. What should matter to you is, even if it's 2030, that is just around the corner. And once you do a full detailed analysis of the degree to which our lives are entirely based on the availability of relatively cheap fossil fuels, totally based on it, and you begin to think that that prop, that structural support to our economies is going to be pulled away from under us, then it begins to look very interesting indeed. Now, that will be determined for the economist amongst you, of course. The answer to that question will in part be determined by the price that we have to pay for a barrel of oil. If the price goes to $100 and over $100, then the depletion of existing reserves will slow, because we will get a lot smarter about using this precious substance than we are today. And boy, do we use it stupidly today. So what about climate change? Can't be avoided. I'm just going to give you a very quick summary of what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us today. I don't know whether this is a source of authority for all of you or whether you're more guided and advised by dissenting, maverick, contrarian scientists who continue to pop up in the woodwork with regular and startling frequency. Indeed, on my interview this morning on one of your local radio stations, I was astonished that out of four questioners, three of them were out to prove that this consensus I'm about to show you is complete rubbish. I can't really try and persuade you to that effect. I just need you to think about what happens when you bring together 2,500 of the world's best scientists, all of whose work is published in peer-reviewed journals, who spent their lifetime trying to give politicians the advice they need. You shouldn't really be putting that advice to one side unless you've got very, very good reasons to do so. This we know. I'm told that people living here in Vancouver definitely know that climate change is happening, as you've had a weird year of it. This is still, of course, contentious. This was the latest figure in the first working group report of the IPCC, that it is 90% certain that it's caused by man-made emissions. Now, wouldn't it be just helpful if they'd offered us 100%? Because then we could have seen off all this residual doubt. But scientists can't do that. That isn't how the scientific method works. And the likelihood of us ever getting to 100% certainty about this is zero. We'll never get there. And that's good and proper, because this kind of scientific debate is important, as long as it's conducted with proper ethical considerations in mind, which means basically not lying about things. Okay. Most importantly, what they say is we've now got this window of time, 10 to 15 years. 30 years ago, when I got going on this, we used to say, hey, this is pretty urgent. We've probably got no more than two generations to get this sorted out. And as I've carried on, the sort of amount of time has shrunk in and in and in. And now here we are looking at this very authoritative group of scientists saying, if we can't create the foundations for change now in 10 to 15 years, we might be reaching that tipping point that I mentioned right at the start. So I won't dwell on this too long. Here are the sort of estimates they give us. 1.8 to 4 degrees centigrade. You don't want to consider what happens at 6.4 degrees centigrade. It's too nasty for words. What that has led to is a very powerful consensus now amongst the scientists, translated through into political consensus as well, that we need to hold the temperature increase below 2 degrees centigrade. Most scientists believe that over 2 degrees centigrade, we may not be able to control the natural feedback loops in the system, which will cause runaway, possibly irreversible climate change. The risks over 2 degrees centigrade look pretty scary. So avoid the risk. Hold it below 2 degrees centigrade, and then we've got a chance of keeping that going. I won't talk too much about the details of this. So this is a sort of interesting reflection. Have we, without knowing it, lived through the most astonishing golden age in the history of humankind, underpinned by the use of this amazing stuff, oil, which we just took for granted. We didn't really think about the fact that 3 tablespoonfuls of oil is the equivalent 8 hours of human labor. You need to know that all of your lives only work the way they work today because you've got the equivalent behind you, making your life possible, of 30, 40, 50 slaves actually delivering that amount of work into the economy on your behalf to give you the standard of life that you have, of living that you have. Take that away, it doesn't look quite so good. Okay, we're through the grisly bit now. That's the worst bit. I just want you to all get into that place, though, because psychologically, if you're not in that place, you're not likely to be thinking through what we now need to do to get us into a much better place in the future. So here are my reasons to be cheerful, really. And I'm going to touch very quickly on these before coming on to the educational stuff. Smart technology. I'm not one of those greenies who believes that technology is the enemy and that all technology is a threat to the well-being of humankind. I don't subscribe to that view. I never have. I don't think it helps us very much. I put here hungry investors. That may be a bit of a threat to some of you, but the truth is, unless we get the world's capital markets really excited about transitioning to a low-carbon, sustainable world, we won't get there. This has all got to be mediated through a capitalist economy. We're not going to have another economy wheeled in from offstage to make this transition any easier. If we're going to do it 10 to 15 years, the reality is we're going to have to do it through a capitalist economy. That's a very hard thing. for a lot of people in the Green Movement to accept very hard, especially those who have deep-seated antipathies towards anything to do with capitalism. I've called it gathering political will. It's a sort of euphemism for at long last they're getting their act together and getting out of decades worth of completely perverse denial, and I welcome that, and I try not to sound too angry when I see how pathetically inadequate their responses still are, because it's happening. Consumers on the move, I'll say a little bit about that. And I still do. I used to teach for 10 years. I still do think there's something just a little bit magical about what's happening with young people today. I'm not going to give you a great enthusiastic plug about the clean tech boom, but I can tell you it is quite exciting. And I meet more and more people now in the work that I do who've got this gleam in their eye about how easy it's going to be to sort out some of these problems. They're the sort of people who think, that's the problem, is it? Well, that's really not difficult. We can really do this. This is not that difficult. And one area where you're seeing that is in what's called the clean tech boom. Investment flows from private investment, capital markets, mainstream investment vehicles, absolutely accelerating hand over fist. Last year, 70 billion. This year, it'll be a lot more. It needs to be a lot more. This is what the International Energy Agency tells us is now required in terms of the very modest 6% target for renewable energy by 2030. 500 billion to get that far. In fact, we need to get much, much further than that. I mean, 6% of our total energy from renewables by 2030 is not going to hack it. We're not going to get through to a carbon-constrained world by 2030 at that level. The EU, I just offer you this. We've had a big debate recently in the EU, and we've agreed this new target now, that 20% of total energy, not just electricity, but total energy, will come from renewables by 2020. That, I can tell you, has really got people's minds focused, like nothing else before. And we're really not sure how we're going to get there. I think a lot of political systems are getting into the place where they can define what the target is without quite knowing every single thing that's going to have to be done to get there. I think this is true of what's just been announced in terms of BC's own energy challenge. How to get there may well have to be revealed over time, but at least you need to know where you're trying to get to. Mind you, slightly controversial figure, as some politicians in Europe think that percentage includes nuclear power. How anybody could describe nuclear power as a renewable source of energy, I do not know, but it's a mysterious world that we move in.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to Jonathan Porritt, one of Britain's leading ecologists, at a speech given May 2nd in Vancouver.
So what's driving this? Well, there's an adage which drives a lot of capitalists that this discontinuity is not necessarily a problem as far as new wealth creators are concerned, because it does precisely what is necessary. It changes the conditions that bring forward new thinking, new ideas, new mindsets, new technologies, new responsibilities. If you talk to any leading business person today, particularly in a global multinational company, the fact that we have got a larger number of failed and failing states than at any other time in human history is not good news for business. The fact that many countries that are once seen to be completely stable and safe now demonstrate all sorts of social stresses and indications that they may not remain stable for much longer is not good news for business. You do not make profits for your shareholders in collapsing states. So there is an acknowledgement that it has to be done differently. Sometimes it's called serving the base of the pyramid, the 4 billion people who do not have access to the kind of lives that we have. Okay, here is the governator. Here's Arnie riding to our rescue. I still have to reflect on the irony of showing you this image, okay? I honestly did not think that it would ever come about in my life that I would hold up before you someone like Arnie Schwarzenegger as an eco-hero. This is a weird place for me to be, I have to admit. Pretty weird. That's a UK-based cartoon. You won't recognize the other two characters. Lagging behind on the bicycle there is David Cameron, shiny new green leader of the Conservative Party in the UK. Talks a mean green streak. Every day he's out there demonstrating how much he cares about the environment. And everybody's beginning to believe him, which is fairly remarkable. More people in the UK think that the Conservative Party would do a better job on the environment than the Labour Party. This really pisses the Labour Party off. Something rotten, I can tell you. And right at the back there is my boss. It's Tony Blair. That's a bit unfair, that cartoon, you know, because actually Tony Blair has done more on the global climate change scene than any other world leader today, without a doubt. More even than the redoubtable Al Gore, of course, who is rapidly coming up and overtaking him, because I don't know how many of you have reflected on this, but the success of An Inconvenient Truth has been startling. It really has had a massive impact. I just have to pay tribute to what he's done through that book and that film, because it's been huge. It's a little bit churlish to ask why he didn't do it about 10 years ago, but nonetheless, the fact that it's happening now is fantastic. So my other reason to be hopeful, consumers on the move, again, difficult for me to reflect on how that's going here in Canada. We've got a ton of stuff going on in Europe now, more and more people beginning to think about all of this stuff, cultural creatives, inner directives, this is all the sort of jargon of the marketing industry that is trying to locate that 20, 25, 30% of consumers who are getting beyond brash consumption for its own sake, looking for a different way, in Maslowian terms, looking for this notion of self-actualization, moving into a better, higher quality of life, even if it means reduced consumption. But I've still offered you a word of warning there. We talk about all this in UK politics. I'm not sure whether you do here. But the one thing we're absolutely not allowed to talk about at all is the idea of less consumption. You can have more ethical consumption, sustainable consumption, environmentally responsible consumption, as long as the adjective in front of consumption still implies that you can go on consuming at the same rate, that's fine. But you offer them less consumption, and that's tantamount to political revolution. But I ask you, the citizens of this fine country of yours, what that means for you. You know this fact, I'm sure, as well as anyone else, that if every single 6.4 billion citizens on the earth today consumed at the level that all of you do, we would need 5 planet Earths. It's only 3 for the UK. I'm not showing off here, but, you know. It's 6.5 if you live in California. It's pretty bad news. The reality, as I'm sure you've all understood, is there is only the one. That's the deal. We don't get any more planets. So as we conduct this astonishing experiment with the one we've got, it makes you think, really, about our wisdom. Now let me move into some educational stuff around this theme of consumption. If consumption was merely a question of buying the things that you need to fulfill your needs on a day-to-day basis, it would be fine. We could get it all sorted. But consumption is not that simple. Over the last 50 years, consumption has become something very different in advanced industrial societies. It has become a proxy for so many other aspects of human nature. So I've just given you a little list there. Yes, it's still about satisfying needs to a certain extent, but actually it's much more now about who we are. What sort of person do we want to be seen to be by our peer group, by our neighbours, by other people? What does it tell us about our status, about our relative standing, positioning in society? There's this astonishing phenomenon that shopping now is the favoured leisure activity of 62% of people in the UK. I mean, for me this is inconceivable. I'm still one of those types who hates shopping and would only go shopping if I absolutely had to go and buy something that I needed. 62% of people in the UK name shopping as their favourite leisure activity. So whether they need something or not is immaterial, because it's leisure. They're out there doing it because that gives them a sense of what? I don't quite know sometimes. Social cohesion, belonging, dreaming, and hedonic desire, and God help me, the pursuit of meaning itself. Now, the great American economist Herman Daly, one of my absolute heroes, a fantastic, deep philosophical economist, that's often an oxymoron, as you know, but a man who has really brought more insights to bear on what we need to do economically than I think most other people, came up with this splendidly simple conceptualization of the problem 30 years ago, is that if political parties think that the route to meeting human needs is via increased flows of goods and services in an economy, then they are sorely deluded. And that was built on by another wonderful Chilean economist, a man called Manfred Max Neefe, who did this beautiful piece of work in the late 70s and early 80s, where he analyzed what he called universal or fundamental human needs. This is a very brave thing to say. He actually believes that every society anywhere in the world, whatever its culture, whatever its dominant religion or belief sets, whatever it might be, that there are these nine fundamental human needs. And then we have satisfiers that change from time to time depending on where the culture is, where society is, where expectation and aspiration is. So we have different satisfiers to meet those fundamental needs. Now, if you think about it, the problem about using consumption to meet those needs is that it's a very, very bad proxy for what we now need to do. Increased consumption, he calls these things pseudo-satisfiers. They offer you the promise, the seduction, that they will satisfy your needs, but in reality they don't. They leave you just as dissatisfied 5 minutes after the purchase as you were before. So, okay, here's my difficult bit, my challenging and hopefully uncomfortable bit. This is generalization, okay, so I know it doesn't apply to this university, obviously. Just says that quickly. And it certainly doesn't apply to anywhere where any of you involved in education are teaching today. All right, this is everywhere else, as it were. But my premise is that education has primarily sold out to this model of human progress via increased consumption and does not see any fundamental philosophical mismatch in that. I think most educational endeavors have been fundamentally corrupted by scientific materialism and are today failing to touch a deeper understanding of what human nature is all about. I think we are in complete thrall, servitude, to this notion of technocratic progress as the means by which societies will be rescued and improved. And I'm sorry to say that I've come to the conclusion that education is part of the problem, not part of the solution. Now, for the reasons that I explained at the start, that's a disaster. That's a complete disaster. Because what it means to say is that every point of the educational cycle, young people are moving through educational experiences which will fashion, form, or reinforce mindsets that will disable them when it comes to understanding the nature of living sustainably on planet Earth. So we are destroying our own seed corn, educational seed corn of hope, by offering an educational experience that is largely detached from the reality that I've just shared with you. So let me share with you the four dominant illusions that I think still underpin most educational endeavor today. Firstly, that the human species is so wondrous and clever and amazingly adaptive to everything that we're completely independent of the rest of life on Earth, of these life forces that sustain us. In fact, I'm going to have to go through all the negative bits first before getting to the reality, okay? We also have the illusion that there are no limits to what we can do. Still, unbelievably, particularly in North America, very, very strong pioneering ethos still that there are no physical limits to what we can do. We have a strong illusion that we're in control, that by virtue of our prowess, our technological prowess, somehow we are managing this situation, and that we are the pinnacle of creation as it has unfolded to date. These are all very, very strongly held core assumptions in people's minds. The reality is, couldn't be more different, unfortunately. We are totally, I use that word very advisedly, we are totally interdependent on other life systems which surround us, of which we are a part. You only need to just play for one moment with one or two aspects of dependency that people forget. Albert Einstein once said, if the bees go extinct, it won't be long before the human species follows. Most young people today have no idea of the fact that our lives are totally dependent on hundreds of pollinators, mostly insects but other creatures, that basically make agriculture possible today. No idea. And that if you removed that particular section of creation, if you like, of created world, our lives would collapse with them. No limits, this is a great sense of our of what we are capable of doing. I am amazed that so few teachers actually can be bothered to understand the laws of thermodynamics. I'm actually fairly amazed that so many engineers are ignorant of the laws of thermodynamics as well. We think we're in control. I'm not sure where you get that idea from, but I think we're going to learn the hard way that that's a pretty stupid view. And some people believe that we are not really the pinnacle of creation, that we are actually, I love this phrase, mammalian weeds, that we've just kind of cropped up at this point in the evolution of life on Earth, and if we don't get our act sorted out, we'll be gone, you know, just like 99% of the species that have been here on Earth over 4.5 billion years, if we screw up, we're out of it. We're gone. End of story. And something else happens. Willis Harmon, wonderful American philosopher, mentor, guide, spiritual leader, summarized all of this as the ontological assumption of separateness, by which he meant that when we try and work out what it is that the human species is here on Earth for, I'm sorry to bring you back to that old question, what on Earth are we here for? We carry around in our minds, even though we don't really want to, an assumption that we are somehow separate from and independent of life on Earth. Even to put it in those terms shows the depths of the philosophical fallacy that we carry around with us. So this whole notion of us somehow being independent of the rest of life on Earth is crucial. Okay, my last sort of foray into this dangerous territory is to share with you five serious psychological illnesses that we are afflicted by today. The first one I call the chronic separateness syndrome, okay? So that's going back to Willis Harmon's idea. I've already explained what that means, that somehow we have this notion that we're different, separate. The second one is what I call multiple denial syndrome. You can see that in every single one of the political parties, individual politicians that you work with. Not every single one. I'm sure there are some here this evening who don't suffer from multiple denial syndrome. But there is an amazingly layered, textured depth of denial in society today, which is extraordinary. And you can see different people at different points on the denial curve. Firstly, you deny the evidence. Then, grudgingly, you have to accept the evidence, but you deny the implications of the evidence. Then, grudgingly, you accept the implications of the evidence, but somehow it's not your responsibility to do anything about those implications. And then you accept your responsibility, and you've taken so long to get to that point, you say, yeah, it's too late though, isn't it, Jonathan? Not much I can do about it now. This is an amazing process that people can go through. You can see it all over the place. Thirdly, we have what I call pre-traumatic stress disorder. This is a rather weird one, and you may not have come across this phenomenon up until now. But this is an interesting one because we don't really have enough pre-traumatic stress disorder. I want to encourage a lot more pre-traumatic stress disorder. I want people to be thinking in a very focused way about the trauma that is about to hit them if we don't get this sorted. I was encouraged to develop this theory by no less a character than Lee Scott, the chief executive of Walmart. Again, another eco-hero that I'm somewhat ashamed to own up in front of you. But Lee Scott, when he went into New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, I don't know whether this is completely true or not, but again, it doesn't really matter, okay? A lot of things don't have to be completely true still to have enormous symbolic power. That's the truth of it. Lee Scott claims that the reason why he put Walmart now on this green trajectory that the company is now on was because of what he saw in New Orleans, what he saw through Hurricane Katrina. And the shock to that system, that epiphany in his life, mandated a process of change in Walmart, which would never have come about. And the way he describes this is very simple. He says, today's ecological crisis is Hurricane Katrina in slow motion. Now, I don't mind how he got to that insight. I don't really care. But he got to it. And it is beginning to have an effect on how that company acts, at least on the environmental bit of it, okay? It's still absolute rubbish on all the social side of it, on the trade union side and the employment conditions and health issues and impacts on community and so on. It's still as bad as it ever was in all of that stuff. But at least it's getting its green act together, which is better than nothing. Now, he suffered. He had a little moment of pre-traumatic stress disorder because he suddenly realized, my God, if this is where we're going, Walmart is never going to make enough money to keep its investors happy. terrific moment of insight. We need a lot more of them. We then have what I call, or I've cribbed this from one of my good mates in England, the affluenza virus. A psychologist called Oliver James has just written this fantastically interesting book about what happens when societies are corrupted by this highly contagious affluenza virus. When our lives are literally taken over by the notion that the only way of being a proper full human being is by becoming more and more affluent, even if it leaves us emptier than we were before we started out. And lastly, and I wish I had a chance to give an entire lecture about this, because this is something very close to my heart. Very, very large numbers of people around the world suffer from nature deficit disorder. Now, I know I'm in Vancouver now. I know I'm in British Columbia. I know you probably don't suffer from NDD as much as we do over there in the old world, where, frankly, a blade of grass is a bit of a companion on a bad day. Now, you're surrounded by the stuff, and I'm reliably informed you get out into it quite a lot. So you're probably less exposed to nature deficit disorder than most people in the Western world. Lucky old you. Because most people today, and many young people today, do not understand how to build a relationship with the living world, have been stripped of that level of meaning in their lives. So there we are. So that brings us into a rather different understanding of what education for sustainable development might look like. We can talk about this stuff now, probably better to do this in discussion. My view about this is that you can't do it just through changing the curriculum. You have to do it by thinking about what is that school or educational establishment telling young people or students about the world in which they live. Is it a reflection of genuinely ethical, responsible, sustainable, equitable living in general, or is it a reflection of the corrupted world in which we live real time today? And it has to be values driven. And here's my last offering to you, really. What does it mean when you talk about values for a sustainable world? I'm just going to leave that up there for you to enjoy. Well, I'm going to leave it up there for you to enjoy, having taken you to one other little place, which is another quote from Albert Einstein, as I hope this will stimulate some thought about the deeper side of this. Einstein was an extraordinary man. He was utterly extraordinary. His insights into what it is that makes human nature what it is are almost, well, to me, as a non-mathematician, more valuable than his mathematical and scientific work. And this is, for me, hugely important. We still think we can sort all of this out by a kind of weird combination of technocratic manipulation of nature, a number-crunching approach to what our relationship needs to look like, a very deep, dark commitment that somehow we can do it through better economics, better science, better technology, and so on. And I don't think that's the case. Unless we address those psychological problems that I showed you a minute ago, will we really be able to arrive in a sustainable world? Right, I'm going to stop banging on at that point and let the discussion flow. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You have been listening to Jonathan Porritt, one of Britain's leading ecologists. The speech, A Sustainable Future, Whose Business Is It Anyway?, was presented by Simon Fraser University at the WASC Center in Vancouver on May 2, 2007. You can download this program and the hour-and-a-half question and answer period from the Climate Solutions section of our Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. We just have time to get a quick sample of the fascinating dialogue with Jonathan Porritt. Adrian Carr, the deputy leader of Canada's Green Party, asks about today's demand to put everything in economic terms, including our need and love for nature. A second question wonders about Porritt's message for the poor of the developing world. Here is Adrian Carr.
Thank you. Adrian Carr, Deputy Leader, Green Party of Canada. I just love this night. I just have to thank you for the people who organized it, Jonathan, for coming and all your comments and questions. I mean, this is, if you talk about critical thinking, I think this is what it's about, being challenged. And I have a confession. you really have woken me up to the fact that I've been spending the last 6-7 years in politics becoming more and more subversive in the form of trying to combat this multiple denial disorder you talk about amongst the other politicians, and moving from a person who worked with the Wilderness Committee and values of and the spirituality of wilderness and nature to framing arguments more and more effectively in economic terms, because that's what seems to have the impact. So I've become quite an expert in quoting Sir Nicholas Stern and his reports, and your own Prime Minister, who goes on and on about the hundreds of thousands of jobs in emerging green technologies and meeting Kyoto objectives at the same time. And it seems to work. It's sort of bringing people on board. Yet I feel like you, this disquiet in myself, because I'm trained as a geographer and I understand the planetary limits to growth. I get it. So I have this disquiet that all the while I'm arguing and know I'm helping move people in society and politics into a more sustainable realm, yet losing at the same time this notion of why we really ought to be doing it. So I'm wondering, first of all, I'd love to hear from any of you in the audience if it would work to drop the economic line. Certainly, I didn't get elected on the non-economic line yet. So, you know, I'd love to get feedback. You're all voters. You know, what would work? I mean, it seems to me like the society that we live in wants politicians to talk the economic line. That's effective. Is it still? I mean, you in this room ought to know you're here. Or should it be the values that you talk about, the spirituality that you talk about, the need to live a life that's more simple, that's more compassionate, that's more in tune with nature? And I want to know what you think it's going to take for the tipping point to happen, to move us not into irreconcilable and out of spiral climate change and disaster, but the tipping point for our world to move to a place where we regain that sense of connection to nature and to each other. And where, when, how, if it's already happening, where is that?
Thank you. My name is Bill Hopwood. I've recently moved back to Vancouver from living in the UK, and I'd love to discuss with Jonathan about the UK, but I'm not going to. Quite a chunk of your talk was about consuming less, particularly apposite here in one of the most privileged countries in the world. My question is, if the audience tonight were people living in a shanty town in an extreme poverty, as in many parts of the world, what would you say to them?
That's a difficult one. Would I be saying anything a great deal differently in essence? Probably not. I would be putting it differently, and I would be saying, please don't be seduced by the incredibly powerful superficial attractions of the consumer-based economic systems that we've developed over the last 150 years, because underneath that seductive appeal, there lies a bedrock of social disaffection, personal dis-ease, a malaise in Western societies that is astonishing. And we've just done a calculation in the UK of what you might call the social costs of living life on this hedonic treadmill, of being caught up in this notion that in order to be happier, you've got to consume more. And it runs to tens of billions of pounds, depending on how you draw the actual figures. The minimum social externality of living the way we live in the UK is around £55 billion a year. And the maximum, depending where you draw the line on different things, is in excess of £100 billion. Now, for very poor people in shanty towns, it's a difficult story to tell that, because they would look at you and say, They would just be completely disbelieving that any group of people given access to wealth, cornucopian benefits on that kind, how they could be unhappy. It would it would leave them incredulous, to say the least, and probably full of contempt at the idiocy of building a society which actually made people systematically less happy through the increased wealth that they have access to. So it would be a difficult discussion, but it would probably be based on an understanding that well-being is a different political concept, a different social, cultural concept than material abundance and economic growth. And well-being lies at the heart of all of this. So, I think that we have to acknowledge that most people in the world today, by virtue of access to mass media, mass global media, probably think the smart way of living is living like we live in this amazing city here. And it's going to take a while to correct what I think is a misperception of where progress really lies. So, how can I end this? Okay, well, the first thing about should you go on with the economics? Of course you should. You can't do this without the economics. You know that. It's just impossible. We're working in a world and trying to bring transformation about in a world that has decided to preference economics over practically every other life skill that might make life better for people today. And you can't therefore give up on that and say, oh, that's not right, because it's not the properly balanced way of doing things, I'm not going to do it at all. This is a creative tension in any social activist, in any agent of transformative change in society. You have to live in more than one world at the same time. And yes, as you have done, and I hope I did this evening, you have to surface the moral tensions that that imposes on us as social activists, but not go for a simplified route, a simplified solution to that. Enjoy the ambiguity. Celebrate the creative tension. Don't give up on it. It's part of your job as an educator not to think that there's only one frame of reality, one frame of reference, which will surface solutions to these problems, because there are multiple frames that we have to try and hold in our mind at the same time without losing our integrity. The issue comes down to, once you feel you've lost your integrity as a person in doing that work, stop it. Give it up at that moment. Don't go any further. Because you can only do work of this kind, transformative work of this kind, if your sense of personal groundedness, of integrity, remains intact. If you lose that, then you're not going to be an agent of change in the way that you want to be. So I guess that would be my line of thinking on that.
That was Jonathan Porritt, one of Britain's leading ecologists, from a dialogue in Vancouver, Canada, on May 2nd. Download his speech and the question and answer period, free, from the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. Next week, British Columbia will join cities like Sydney and Paris in an experiment to voluntarily reduce electricity. On the evening of May 16th, BC Hydro and the 30 Days of Sustainability crowd ask you to turn off the lights and unnecessary electronics in your home or business. It's called Turn It Off BC, and you can find out more at www.30daysofsustainability.com. Remember, the night of May 16th, that's a Wednesday, see how far you can cut the lights and the power. That sends a signal we care about climate change and air quality. With voluntary reductions, we won't need to build more polluting power plants. In next week's show, we'll be assessing the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the map for survival proposed by the world's leading scientists. And, of course, we'll have to whack the usual oily climate deniers that pop into the media every time positive solutions come out from real scientists. Find it next week on Radio EcoShock here on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Fridays at 1 o'clock. By satellite on Star Choice, Channel 845. By cable. Or on your community radio station. That's right, Radio EcoShock is now being broadcast on a variety of stations in Canada and the United States. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and as always, I appreciate your tuning in to our world situation. Let's go out with a little homespun advice from Dan Berger.
The faucet drips, the floorboard squeaks, the roof is always leaking. What do you do when you got a loose screw? Fix it or stop complaining. There's a hole in the bucket, there's a hole in the shoe, a hole up in the ozone, there's a hole in the screen, and I just got bit. Fix it or stop complaining. give it your best, get a good grip, give it more elbow, a little less lip. Ask for help if the job's too big, fix it or stop complaining.